Good evening. Open your Bibles to Acts chapter 7. Acts chapter 7 will continue the sermon that Stephen preached to the Sanhedrin, to the Jewish leaders there in Acts chapter 7. Rather a lengthy sermon as far as biblical standards go. The length of it's rather long, but I mentioned last week that a lot of people say that Stephen's sermon isn't that important to know or to understand because it's just a history lesson. And I think we're going to see tonight as we progress along that it's much more than a history lesson. We talked last week about the beginning of the sermon. We talked about some perceived contradictions of the Bible that we see come out in what Stephen says. Specifically, we spent a good bit of time last week discerning the 400 years, the 430 years, that time frame that existed between the time that Abraham received the promise in Genesis chapter 15 and the time that the Israelites were brought out of the land of Egypt and into the wilderness and out to Sinai to where they would receive the law of Moses. Well, Stephen begins in verse 8 to talk about this 430-year time span that we've just discussed, that he's just mentioned. And, you know, he talks about he begins all the way back with Abraham in verse 8. He says, "And he gave him the covenant of circumcision. And so Abraham became the father of Isaac and circumcised him on the eighth day. And Isaac became the father of Jacob and Jacob of the 12 patriarchs." Once again, you know, as Stephen begins this lesson, as he begins this sermon to these men, and you remember this is a hostile audience. This is certainly not a group that's enjoying or wanting to hear what Stephen has to say, but they're going to hear it anyway. You know, as he begins this, I'm sure that they're all shaking their head. Yes, these are things they love. You know, talk about Abraham. Talk about him coming out of Ur. Talk about the promises that God made. Those are great. Those all are about us. We love those things. Those are our bread and butter. Keep it coming, Stephen. And probably he's enduring himself to them right now. But he's quickly going to show them something about that history that they are not going to be very fond of as he brings, you know, sometimes we have selective memory when it comes to history, don't we? See, I tell my mother, and I she's not here this week, so I can tell you that, this. I tell my mother, I said, "Mother, you had the fastest hand in Mississippi. You could slap my face, and I never saw your hand move. Just a sting." She goes, "I never slapped you in the face." I'm like, "Yeah, you did." "No, I did not." So that's the running argument now, is that I say she did, and she said. So we got selective memory about things we don't want to remember, or, you know, that we don't want to admit to, I guess. We called that at camp with teenagers when they, you know, they do something, we go, I don't know. And we go, "You got CML, convenient memory loss." And, you know, I think oftentimes we get that. And certainly the Pharisees here and the Sadducees, the Jewish leadership, all had CML. Well, he begins here with Abraham. He begins with circumcision. Circumcision certainly being one of those center point issues there with the Jews. It was very important to them. It was a fleshly sign of the promise to Abraham and his descendants. Abraham was circumcised when he was 99 years old, 1 year before Isaac was born. He also circumcised Ishmael when he was 13 years old in Genesis chapter 17. In verses 24 and 25. Now, Stephen is going to make a contrast here. There's a contrast between fleshly circumcision and a circumcision of a spiritual nature. Circumcision, maybe as Paul puts it, a circumcision of the heart, right? You know, that they were good with the externals, they were good with the fleshly things, but the problem with these guys is not the fleshly or the externals. The problem with these guys still has to do with the inside, right? It's still the things that Jesus said. There are still those whitewashed tombs that look pretty on the outside, but on the inside, they're just simply full of dead men's bones. They're full of all kinds of uncleanness. And so, you know, we're still dealing with that. While every one of those men would have been circumcised, none of those men lived up to what circumcision meant, did they? None of them lived to the covenant that God had passed down to them through the years. You know, then we quickly go in this text through Isaac and Jacob, ending this verse with the 12 sons of Jacob, or as Stephen refers to them, the 12 patriarchs. And so he kind of jumps over quite a bit of history there real quick and goes right down to the 12 patriarchs. And then he says in verse 9, and now he's going to begin to make he's about to make this differentiation. It's about to begin. There's about to be something in the lesson that's going to start making the Pharisees feel a little bit uneasy. Because he's not going to be just talking about the warm and fuzzy stuff that they love anymore. He's going to get down to some things that really happened. He says, the patriarchs became jealous of Joseph and sold him into Egypt. Yet God was with him. With who? He was with Joseph. He wasn't with the brothers, was he? He wasn't with the patriarchs. He wasn't with, you know, his 10 brothers that did those things to him. Benjamin was not a part of it. But he was not with them. Stephen addresses the jealousy of the 10 patriarchs toward their brother and Joseph and what that jealousy caused them to do. And Stephen has mentioned cherished promises of the Jewish heritage, and now he's going to address the sinfulness that existed in that very same heritage. That yes, you can brag about being sons of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and sons of the patriarchs, but let me tell you what happened. Let's look at how they lived. Let's look at the things that they did. And this is where Stephen begins to create a parallel between his audience and the characters and the events that exist within their own history, a history that they are so very proud of. And these men that Stephen is speaking to have done terrible things like the patriarchs that they hold in such high esteem because of their own jealousy. Can you begin to see the parallel here? It is the jealousy of these men, it is their envy of Jesus Christ that caused them to put him on the cross. Just like the patriarchs, in their jealousy, were ready to kill. Had it not been for Reuben, they would have killed Joseph, but they sold him into slavery. And so they're guilty of the same sins. They're guilty of the same thing that their patriarch fathers, that they're so proud of, that they did to Joseph. God was with Joseph. He wasn't with them. God was with Jesus, not with them, right? There's a parallel that Stephen's beginning to draw. And he's going to continue to draw this as we go down through the text. You know, when we talk about that they put Jesus Christ on the cross because of envy, we see that very clearly in what Pilate says. Even Pilate, a pagan Roman, could look at this situation and discern it. Because in Matthew chapter 27, verse 18, we read, "For he knew that because of envy they handed him over." Even Pilate knew it. These guys were jealous of Jesus. They were jealous of his popularity. They were jealous of what he did. They were jealous of the fact that they never could beat him in an argument, I guess. They envied him and they put him to death because of it. Now, Joseph is now going to be a foreshadowing of Jesus Christ in this lesson by Stephen. So even though Joseph's brothers had done evil to Joseph, God was with them. Well, the next verse elaborates on how God was with Joseph. It says in verse 10, "And rescued him from all his afflictions and granted him favor and wisdom in the sight of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and made him governor over Egypt and all his household." Okay, tell me some afflictions that Joseph went through. First of all, what's the first affliction? He was sold into slavery by his brothers. He was sold into it. How did God deliver Joseph from that? Yes. Yes, Potiphar seemed to be a very good man. It wound up, you know, everything that Joseph did was blessed by God, and therefore that got him in. You know, Potiphar likes anything. And, you know, if you have a servant and everything he does just prospers, you're going to make sure that servant does a lot, right, or is in charge of a lot. And so Potiphar basically puts him over everything. He's, you know, even tells Potiphar's wife, doesn't he? You know, I'm over everything. Everything is, you know, I have my hand on everything except you. I don't, you know, you're not under me. You're not somebody that I have any kind of authority with. Somebody say Nathan? Or am I just hearing stuff? Okay. I thought somebody said Nathan like they were trying to get my attention. So he was sold into slavery. Okay, what's his next affliction? As we look at how God was with him, what Stephen says. Potiphar's wife, she tries to seduce him, lies, and says that, you know, he tried to rape her, and Potiphar really has no choice but to place Joseph in prison. Now, as we study the story, we see that Potiphar, based on his title, is actually the man in charge of the royal prison. So, you know, Potiphar most likely keeps Joseph pretty close. I think he probably knows Joseph and his wife and probably could tell which one was which. And he puts him in not some dank dark prison, but the royal prison, and which he was already in charge of. And so even in that situation then, things turn out pretty well there too, don't they? He becomes what, basically, what we call it today? like a trustee, or you know, he was someone that they left in charge. They didn't worry about him trying to escape. They didn't worry about him trying to leave. You know, they trusted Joseph to those things. So he had as good a life as you could have in prison. He had, you know, it went pretty well. Well, while he was there, he had the opportunity, didn't he, to the last thing that he says here, we're going to have to tie Pharaoh in here. The last thing that he says here is that he had favor with Pharaoh. Well, he found that favor after he interpreted two dreams. He interpreted two dreams of two men that were brought to prison. What were those? What were the occupations of those two men? Butler, cupbearer, and the baker. The baker and the cupbearer came to him, and they both had a dream, right? And baker had, you know, the three baskets of food, baked food for Pharaoh in his head, and the birds were eating out of his baskets. And you know, what does that mean? And he said, 3 days, three baskets, 3 days. That your head, it's funny, he says the same phrase for both of them, but it means a different thing. Your head will be lifted up off your shoulders, and the birds will come and eat from you. And so he was going to be killed in 3 days. And then, you know, the cupbearer had the three grapevines, right, growing, and they bloomed and they grew grapes, and he squeezed the grapes. He had Pharaoh's cup in his hand. He squeezed the grapes, and he handed the cup to Pharaoh, and he said, 3 vines, 3 days, and your head will be lifted up, and you will be returned to your position with Pharaoh. Now, when he interprets the cupbearer's dream, he asks the cupbearer a favor. What is he asking? Remember me. You know, when you get back with Pharaoh, remember me. And what does the Bible promptly say the cupbearer did?
Forgot.
And how long did Joseph spend in prison after that? 2 more years. You know, we're not just in overnight or a 60-day stint here. It's not one of those Britney Spears stays, right? It is a lengthy period of time. So he's there for 2 more years, and suddenly Pharaoh has a dream. Actually, a couple of dreams. And he has the dream, and we know the dream well, right? The fat cows, the skinny cows. And the skinny cows ate the fat cows, and you had the full, plump grain head, yes, thank you for the word. I needed that head. And you had the kind of the scorched and scrawny head of grain, and they literally, you know, consumed the fat grains, and Pharaoh wanted to know what was going on. Well, at this particular time, and probably at threat that everybody was about to get killed if somebody didn't answer Pharaoh's question, cupbearer suddenly remembers somebody that can interpret dreams, a man named Joseph back in prison. So he ends up coming there. See, God in the interpretation of the dreams for these guys is what led him to Pharaoh. And then he goes to Pharaoh and he says, God will give you your answer. And he tells him what the dreams meant. Dreams meant what?
7 years.
Yeah, you're going to have 7 real good years, and then you're going to have 7 really bad years. Okay? And so Pharaoh is very thankful to Joseph for interpreting this dream. He makes him second in the kingdom, what we would call maybe his grand vizier. He is number 2. I mean, he has pretty much all authority. The only person that can veto or override him is Pharaoh himself. So Joseph becomes a very powerful man. He goes from prison to being the second in one of the most powerful kingdoms, probably the most powerful kingdom of the day. And he becomes that, and he has a purpose. He is brought forward by Pharaoh to prepare for this great famine. And Joseph does a very good job in doing this, and certainly with God's great blessing. Well, it says, and let's go ahead and read that, and we'll talk more about that. Now a famine came over all Egypt and Canaan, and great affliction with it, and our fathers could find no food. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent our fathers there for the first time. Or they're the first time. They're going to go more than once. So Joseph did his job, and when the 7 years of plenty were done, Egypt had food. Egypt had grain. You know, they still find these great underground granaries that were probably made during the days of Joseph, where they stored the grain. And so he has stored all this food, and in fact, as a result of Joseph's efforts and God's blessing, Egypt becomes vastly wealthy, do they not? Some believe that this is actually the beginning of the vast wealth. You know, it was said of Egypt that gold was like water. Or water was, you know, they had lots of gold, they had a little bit of water. And this is probably one of the places where that began, because people came from all over and paid Egypt for the food. They were also one of the first countries to actually own all the land in their country, because they had Joseph had the people come and give their land to, they would be able to keep it but the government actually owned it. Very unique time as Joseph guided them through this time. But they had the food, and here they come. His brothers come to him. Now, Jacob in this first time sent all of his sons except who? Benjamin. Why won't he send Benjamin? Benjamin's so spoiled. Yeah, he was the other son of Rachel. Rachel had died giving birth to Benjamin. And he, having lost, or what he believes, he lost Joseph, right? Because they brought back the coat of many colors, and they brought back that bloody coat and said an animal had torn him to shreds, basically. And here is Benjamin now. Now Benjamin is that favored son because he's the son of Rachel, because all these others are the sons of Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah. And they're not going to be the son, you know, his favorite, because he favored Rachel. And in fact, the reason why Rachel was not allowed to have any children for so long was because of Joseph. I'm sorry, because of Jacob. I've got a ton of names flying around in my head. Because of Jacob. He had Leah have children and would not allow Rachel because Jacob would not love Leah. And God expected him to love her, expected him to treat her right. And so it was some time before she had Joseph, and then she had Benjamin. So he's not going to let Benjamin out of his sight. Well, there's something to be seen in this story that just like the Jews, the first dealing that Joseph's brothers had with Joseph ended in them attempting to get rid of him because of their jealousy, right? And when you look at these guys that Stephen's talking to, their first encounter with Jesus Christ and his ministry upon this earth ended with their envy putting him to death, trying to get rid of him, right? We see a parallel there, that they are paralleling the brothers of Joseph who God was with, and while Jesus, God was with him, and yet they persecuted him. And then we see that the second encounter that Joseph's brothers have with Joseph required that they come to him that they might find salvation from physical starvation. He was their Savior. They had to come to him, they had to do what he said, or they would not receive what they needed. They would not have salvation. And the Jews' second encounter with Christ is through the church, it's through the apostles, it's through the teachings. Here's through men such as Stephen now, who are speaking by guidance of the Holy Spirit. And this is their second opportunity. What are you going to do with it? Because salvation's on the line, isn't it? Just like for the brothers. You have another chance in salvation. You've got to come to Christ now for salvation. Peter said, there's salvation in no other name. He's already said that to these men in Acts chapter 4. Or Acts chapter 3, rather. He said that to these men. There is salvation in no other name except Jesus. And so, you know, we see that parallel going along here that they needed to do. You know, no lineage is going to help them at this point. Salvation is Jesus Christ. Looking back to Abraham, looking back to your lineage is not going to save you. It's not going to mean anything anymore. No obedience to the old law is going to do anything for you. No religious office that you may hold like these men held is going to help you. No amount of good deeds outnumbering bad, which was one of their primary formulas, is going to, at this point, be able to save you outside of Jesus Christ. They had to come to him. Just as Joseph's brothers had to go to him because that's where the food was. And that's the only place the food was. And the only place salvation is in Jesus Christ. Verse 13 says, on the second visit, Joseph made himself known to his brothers. We know that, you know, he did that. He cried and he came out and he embraced them. They were scared, of course. You know, wouldn't you be? Here's a man that, you know, all he had to do was snap his fingers. These guys are dead. And they ain't nobody. They don't answer to anybody except Pharaoh. And he could tell Pharaoh, you know, and Pharaoh would go, yeah, you know, I kind of see your point there. I wouldn't be too nice to guys that sold me into slavery either. And so, you know, here's a guy. But, you know, Joseph shows us his godliness and why God was with him and his responses, right? He said, am I in the place of God? You know, in fact, he deals with this twice here, and then he deals with it when Jacob dies, and they're worried that he was just waiting until Jacob died to kill him because he didn't want to break the heart of his father. And so he said, you know, he says, am I in the place of God? But he tells them also, God, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. You know, he meant it for good. He meant it for salvation of many, right? You know, and even when you look at the Jews, what they did was evil, but God made good out of it, didn't he? They put Jesus Christ to death, but the good was the fact that salvation was provided in that act. in what took place and Jesus Christ laying down His life for all. Well, just like Joseph, this second opportunity brings with it the opportunity for it to have a new home. Egypt for Jacob and his sons and their family and 75 people in all, as he is going to say in the next verse, they had the opportunity to come there. The church we have today in heaven, ultimately, as our heavenly home, a new home. Well, verse 14 says, then Joseph sent word and invited Jacob, his father, and all his relatives to come to him, 75 persons in all. So they came to Egypt. They lived in Goshen, the richest area of the land. So they didn't just come and, you know, stick them out in the desert. They stuck them up there in the delta area where it was nice. Nice place to grow things. It was fertile. And so, you know, this was a good thing that they did. You know, Jesus has invited these Jewish leaders. He invites us as well today to come unto Him. You know, Dale, I was thinking during your devotional, I like that, by the way. I thought a lot of sermon ideas popped up into my head. You know, it's kind of like, come unto me is kind of a friend request, isn't it? It's kind of a family request. You know, come unto me. Come be in my family. So, you know, when we talk about Facebook and all the types of networking stuff, there's some parallels there that we could look at. Verse 15 says, and I know y'all are going, man, he's getting through lots of verses tonight. I know. Patrick can hardly believe it. Considering last night in an hour and 10 minute class, I got through two verses. And the second verse only took me about 2 minutes. So one verse for the vast majority of time last night in class. Verse 15, and Jacob went down to Egypt, and there he and our fathers died. From there they removed to Shechem, and laid in the tomb which Abraham had purchased for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor in Shechem. Well, we know that Jacob was buried with Abraham in Machpelah, which was actually near Hebron. And Hebron was just a little bit south of the town of the New Testament town of Bethlehem. Genesis chapter 15, verse 13 tells us that. Stephen here, though, makes it clear that Jacob and all the 12 patriarchs were buried in a tomb in Shechem. It's a tomb that, according to Joshua chapter 24 and verse 32, that Jacob actually bought. Now, Jacob is a descendant of Abraham. The saying Abraham is not an issue there because it was bought, you know, from his grandson, basically, for this burial. And we know that Joseph in Exodus chapter 13 and verse 9, after he died, he was basically, as an Egyptian ruler, he would have been what? Mummified. We know that he went through that length of time that was necessary to do that. And he was put in a coffin and he remained there until the Israelites left and they took his bones with them. And they buried him there then in Joshua after they had come into the land of Canaan in Joshua 24 and 32. You know, also talking about Shechem here may be a hint because we are one chapter away, chapter 8, from taking the gospel to what group of people? The Samaritans, all right? So, you know, Jesus said, I want you to be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the uttermost reaches of the world. So we're clicking up another notch here. We're about to go to Samaria. And he mentions Shechem. So these 12 patriarchs that you hold in such high esteem, where are they buried? In Samaria. They're not even buried in Judah. You know, and so, you know, this place, this area of land that they would not even travel through. They would take the long way around. Remember, they would take the long way around the Jordan River. They'd go out on the east side of the Jordan River and go all the way around Samaria to get back to Galilee. And that's why Jesus, sometimes we believe, went straight through Samaria because it was a whole lot easier for him. He didn't have to deal with the crowds. And so he would go through Samaria instead. And so, talks about their being buried there. Verse 17, but as the time of the promise was approaching, which God assured to Abraham, the people increased and multiplied in Egypt. The promise of delivering the people, when he talks about this promise that's approaching, it's that promise that God made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 15 that while they would be enslaved, they would be delivered as well. And so that time was approaching, and during that time they multiplied at a great rate. You know, they were there for 215 years. I mean, you think about that for just a moment. Let's put that into some kind of chronology that we can maybe put our hands around. Our nation has been around, what, 235 years? They were there for 215. So they were almost in Egyptian slavery or in Egypt as long as we have been a nation. And during that time, they rapidly reproduced from 75 people to probably somewhere in the range of a couple of million. And you know, just from the way the Bible talks about it and Exodus talks about it, this appears to be something abnormally abrupt. You know, abnormal multiplication. Maybe, you know, less infant death. There was a lot of infant death in the ancient world. You know, maybe more twins. Who knows? I mean, we certainly see plenty of twins in Genesis, don't we? And so, you know, maybe more births like that, but they're having lots of children. And to the point that it becomes a threat to the Egyptian people, to the Egyptian king. And that's where we see in verse 18, it says, until, so they were multiplying in Egypt until there arose another king over Egypt. And this is once again going back to the beginning of Exodus, over Egypt, who knew nothing about Joseph. And it was he who took shrewd advantage of our race and mistreated our fathers so that they would expose their infants and they would not survive. You notice, you pay attention to how Stephen says, our fathers, our race, right? He's still, I am a Jew still, but you need to understand that there's more to being a Jew than just a name and circumcision and a lineage, that you need to be faithful. Well, there arose a Pharaoh that did not remember what Joseph had done to save and Egypt and to make Egypt wealthy. And he looked around and saw this foreign group of people in the land, and he decided they were multiplying too fast, and so he decided to do what with the male children? Kill them. Toss them into the Nile River. Lots of alligators and the water itself. I mean, you know, the Nile was a god. I mean, I'm sure this was almost like a sacrifice for them. You know, they're offering these children to their god, their god of life. Because the Nile was life. If you didn't have the Nile, you didn't have Egypt. You know, while Egypt, you know, today has all these borders way out here, really Egypt only existed right on the Nile's banks. And outside of that, there was nothing beyond that. So, you know, they were intimidated and therefore they did this heinous crime of killing children. Well, in verse 20, it was at this time that Moses was born, and he was lovely in the sight of God. Now, I don't think that just means he was a cute baby. All babies are cute, right? Especially grandbabies and your own babies. But, you know, I don't think he's talking about his cute. He's lovely in the eyes of God because God, as Dale mentioned, he knew him from his birth. He knew exactly what Moses was set to do. This is what God's been waiting for. He's been waiting for Moses. And Moses is here now, and God is glad of that. And he looks down upon Moses and blesses him. Now, he was nurtured 3 months in his father's home. So they hid him, basically, obviously. They hid him from those that would try to kill him for 3 months. And after he had been set outside, and that has to do with, you know, basically her putting him in the ark and the bulrushes and in the Nile River, you know, setting him loose to that exposure. Pharaoh's daughter took him away and nurtured him as her own son. Pharaoh, he was not considered a son of Pharaoh. You know, we see movies like Prince of Egypt and stuff like that. He was not considered a son of Pharaoh. He was a son of Pharaoh's daughter. He was not in line to the throne in any shape, fashion, or form. And in fact, he knew he was a Hebrew. They knew he was a Hebrew. And, you know, there was no sense in which he was going to ever be the leader of Egypt from that heritage. It says, Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power and word, and words and deeds. So we have this, you know, we see the narrative here as he briefly lays it out of the birth and the salvation of Moses from this persecution that was brought down upon the children. Moses was also highly educated there in Egypt. He was in Pharaoh's house. He was a royal member of the house. And so he would have received the very highest in education. Well, it says that he was a man of power and words, right? What did Moses think about himself in words? Yeah. Yeah, I'm not very, you know, I'm not very eloquent. And you know, we don't really know. You know, you got Charlton Heston. He was a pretty eloquent Moses. I kind of like the Ten Commandments with Ben Kingsley because he kind of stuttered and stammered around. But, you know, it's not really clear that Moses wasn't a good speaker as much as that was just an excuse. Because even though Aaron is assigned to be his mouthpiece to speak for him, Aaron never speaks. It's always still Moses speaking. You know, even though Aaron's the one sent, it still ends up being Moses. I guess Moses finally said, well, I've got to do it anyway. Might as well do the talking too. And so, but not only here, this power in words does not necessarily imply eloquence either. Let's make that clear. It means that what he said meant something. You ever known people that talked and never really said all that much? Don't mention any names. And don't point at me. We have those people, right? And then there's people that when they speak, you want to make sure you hear every single word, right? Because they're going to tell you something you need. They're going to give you something that's going to change your life. And so, you know, that could be a definition here. So power in words and his power in his deeds or his actions. You know, his deeds were certainly stuff of legend, weren't they? I mean, Moses did some pretty incredible stuff by the power of God. You know, God actually said, I am going to make you a god. I'm going to make it appear like you're a god. You're going to do some pretty incredible stuff out of your staff and by your command. A lot of things are going to happen. Now, it's all from the power of God, but it's going to be coming through the hands or through the staff at times of Moses. And so God was literally going to make him appear to be a god. So, I mean, certainly his deeds were powerful as well. Verse 23, it says, but when he was approaching, and this is very interesting because there was something I read in this that kind of gave me an understanding that I never had before, you know, in talking about and teaching Exodus, because you don't often come up to Stephen to reference what takes place in Exodus, but there's an interesting thing Stephen says here, and Stephen's speaking by the Holy Spirit, so we take it as truth, and we apply it back to Exodus. It says, but when he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. And when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, we know this story, he defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. Can't you just hear the Jews are going, that's right, he sure did, he got him. He struck down that old Egyptian for beating on a Jew. And so he says he does that. But listen to what verse 25 says, because this is what's interesting. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. How many here thought that the first idea Moses ever got of delivering the Israelites came at the burning bush? Because we're 40 years early. That's 80. He's 80 when he's at the burning bush. And yet right here he says he thought they would understand that God was granting deliverance through him when he killed that Egyptian. And so Moses in some way and in some sense apparently knew that he had a divine charter to deliver the Israelites. Now maybe this is a case of Moses doing it his way and it not working out so well, right? Because God certainly had his way that worked and worked very well. But, you know, it makes sense here as we think about this. Think about Hebrews chapter 11, verses 24 through 26, where it says, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. Friends, that verse cannot be applying to the burning bush. He'd already left Egypt. He was no longer a part of the riches of Egypt. He was no longer a part of the royal family by the time he was at the burning bush. This had to take place at this time when he went to be with his people, as Stephen says. He wanted to go and see his people. It's obviously that choice that he's made. I'd rather be with my people, and he knows he's a Hebrew quite obviously. I'd rather be with my people and suffer affliction with them than to remain in the house of Pharaoh, right? This is where Hebrews chapter 11 is talking about. It's not talking about the choice he makes at the bush, because that's not the choice he makes at the bush. He doesn't even get to make much of a choice at the bush, does he? God didn't give him much of a choice. I mean, it's not like, okay, God, I'll do it. No, God says, you're going to do it. I made your mouth. You don't tell me what you can't do. And he leaves. Go. Kind of like the way my mama. I didn't have any choice with my mama. And so here we see Hebrews chapter 11. And I think sometimes we fail to recognize that. I know I have. That this is talking about here, that Moses had faith, he had an understanding about God, at least a cursory understanding of what God wanted him to do, even at the time that he killed the Egyptian. Long before. He killed the Egyptian not just because he was upset because the Egyptian was beating the Jew, but because he was ready to deliver him.
And his first step was to get that Egyptian off that Jew, off that Israelite, right? I'm saying Jew, but Israelite. Was to get that guy off of him. Well, you know, and it did, you know, he killed the Egyptian apparently as that first step and kind of a baby step, but thinking that they would appreciate his efforts and believing that they would see that he's from God there to deliver them, but they certainly do not. They often fail to see anything that God did. And this is another condemnation that Stephen's beginning to build and to show that what God does for you, you never recognize it. And you reject it and you turn it away. The people that God sends to help you, you constantly reject them. Well, it says on the following day, though, he appeared to them as they were fighting together, and he tried to reconcile them in peace. See, he's trying to be a leader. And saying, men, you are brethren, why do you injure one another? But the one who was injuring his neighbor pushed him away, saying, who made you a ruler and judge over us? Well, God. You do not mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday, do you? So they reject Moses' help. They reject what he has done. They constantly reject the help of God throughout their history. And there is a clear pattern developing here of stubbornness, jealousy, and rebellion. And what we're seeing throughout this narrative that Stephen's laying down is we're seeing faithful people, faithful individuals, aren't we? And unfaithful people. We're seeing a small minority being faithful, but the vast majority of Israelites being unfaithful. And you're getting these highlight characters, Moses, Joshua, you know, David. You're getting the faithful, but the vast majority of people aren't. And you come down to the New Testament, you've got Jesus, and the vast majority aren't. And Stephen's beginning to lay this out. Well, I think as we think about the burning bush, let me hold off. Let's read a few verses here. Let's read through verse 34, and then we'll kind of tie that together. At this remark, Moses fled and became an alien in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. And after 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai. This is in the beginning of the book of Exodus chapter 3. An angel appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai in the flame of a burning thorn bush. And when Moses saw it, he marveled at the sight. And as he approached to look more closely, there came the voice of the Lord, I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And Moses shook with fear and would not venture to look. But the Lord said to him, take off the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. I have certainly seen the oppression of my people in Egypt and have heard their groans, and I have come down to rescue them. Come now, and I will send you to Egypt. Thinking about what we just said, Moses is trying to take the first step of delivering the people when he kills that Egyptian, right? Do we understand better why he says, why would they listen to me? Do we understand better why he says, who do I say sent me? Because what was it? Who has made you judge and ruler over us, right? Moses may not be making so much excuse. Now, his mouth thing is an excuse. But on those early questions, may not have been as much an excuse as trying to find the answers he needed to answer what was already done. He reminds me a lot of Peter. He reminds me of Peter in Gethsemane when Peter yanked out the sword and took on the mob, right? He was all ready to go, but it wasn't the way the Lord wanted him to do it. And he kind of got rebuked, right? He kind of got slapped down because he kind of jumped the gun, maybe went on his own his own mind or his own wisdom. And it wasn't what the Lord wanted. And it just broke him, didn't it? It just kind of, when the Lord said, put the sword away, he who lives by the sword dies by the sword. You know, Peter didn't know what to do then. And I think we see Moses in the same kind of mold, don't we? He tried to do something, it didn't work, and then he didn't know what to do. And so he ran away. Peter ran away the same night. And so I see some similarities there, but I think we begin to understand a little better Moses' apprehension there at the bush when we understand that he was already trying to deliver them 40 years earlier. This is not his first introduction to this concept, according to Stephen. And so that's according to God. So, you know, he tried it his way and it didn't work. But now God says, I've got my way coming. And I'm going to deliver my people, right? You're not going to deliver them, Moses. I'm going to deliver them. I'm going to use you. And, you know, it's about remembering where the power is in this particular situation. God does that quite often, doesn't he? Jesus did that with the disciples. God did that with Abraham, didn't he? In the birth of Isaac. I'm going to show you, Isaac, I'll give you a son, but I'll give it in my own good time so that you know it was me. And, you know, he wanted the Egyptians to know. And Moses, when he spoke to Moses, he said, the Egyptians are going to know that I am who? I am God. Before this is over, the 10 plagues were not just to get Pharaoh to change his mind, okay? God could have made Pharaoh change his mind on the first day if God had so chosen. I mean, he could have brought down enough wrath and fury in one plague to change Pharaoh's mind. The object was in the 10 plagues that the people would know he's God. That I did it. It's not only for the Egyptians. The Egyptians are going to know that I'm God. But he also wanted the Israelites to know that you were only delivered because of me as well. Which they promptly forget after they pass through walls of water. And these people amaze me. You know, they had better be glad that I was not in charge of their fate. Because I am not a patient person in that as patient as God is with people like that. Well, this Moses, listen to what it says in verse 35. If I don't think I've heard the second bell yet. It says, this Moses, whom they disowned. Excuse me? Disowned. How many godly men did these people disown? They didn't want him. Who made you a ruler and judge? Saying, who made you a ruler and judge is the one whom God sent to be both a ruler and a deliverer with the help of the angel who appeared to him in the burning thorn bush. The one that you disowned is the one God chose. Just shows you how smart we are, right? One our wisdom would choose is not the one God would choose. That's exactly what God told Samuel, right? When he's looking at the sons of Jesse, he said, oh, don't look at the outside. We already had the king that looked like a king, right? Saul, head and shoulders above everybody else. Don't look at the outside. I'm looking at something more important. What's on the inside? We'll pick up there with verse 35 and talk a little bit more about people that the Israelites disowned. I think that's like 30 verses, Patrick. Might be a record. Appreciate your good attention and comments, Don.